Hi everyone, we're going to get started. Today we're going to be talking about a halting problem. Just continuing talking about kind of the philosophical issues, a few mathematical paradoxes, and stuff like that. Let's start with some quicker questions. So the first two questions talk about this, this new kind of sorting called a swap sort. So I'm going to explain, on this slide, I'm going to explain what swap sort is. So when you do swap sort, you're trying to sort a list from the smallest to the biggest element in the list. And so the way you do it is you start from right to left, and whenever you look at two neighbors, if they're not in the right order, you swap them. So this will make the smallest number, going through the list one time, will make the smallest number going to the first position. So in this case, 272 is the smallest number in the list. In the beginning, it's on the second to last position, and it needs to go all the way to the front. So you're going to go right to left, and you're going to say 272, you're going to compare 272 with 294. They're in the right order. You're going to compare 272 with 693. You're going to swap them, and so on all the way down. Okay? So in this case, if you have 10 elements, 272 needs to be swapped 8 times to get to the first position. Any questions about that? Okay. So the question is, if there are n numbers in the list, what's the most number of swaps you have to do to bring the smallest number in the first position? So the smallest number to the left. Okay, so just one time going through the list, you have n numbers, what's the most number of swaps? And the options are A, it's 2n, B, it's n, C, n plus 1, D, n squared, E, n minus 1. Stopping at 2:30. 5 more seconds. Stopping. Okay, good choice. So, in the worst case, your smallest element is in the last position. And then you have to do n minus 1 swaps to bring the smallest numbers all the way to the left. Okay, good. Now imagine you use this method to sort the whole list of numbers. So, given how long it takes to get one item all the way to its place to the left, how long does it take to sort the whole list this way? And the options are A, big O of log n, B, big O of n, C, big O of n log n, D, big O of n squared, and E, big O of 2 to the n. Stopping at 1:30. Stopping. Okay, more spread out, but the majority got the right answer. So let's see why. Okay, so let's say this is your list of n numbers. It doesn't look very straight, but let's just say that it's a number, right? First element, second element, blah, 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 and the element. So what you do in the worst case, you're small, in the worst case, what's the worst case? The worst case is when it's sorted completely in the, so the biggest, in descending order, right? So the biggest are in the front, the small are in the back of the list. And so to move this guy, you need, how many operations did we say that we need to do if this is a small element in the list? N minus one. Okay, so now your smallest number is in the, all the way to the left. You've accomplished that. Now your second number, the smallest number, is all the way to the right. How many swaps do you have to do to bring this guy all the way here? Probably a minus three. And so on. This is, it's not exactly the 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus blah blah blah, but it's very close to that. It's the, you know, if you look at the sum of all the odd numbers, all the first n odd numbers, the sum of all the and even numbers, there we go next way. What does this sorting remind you of? Which sortings that we talked last time? What is it very similar to? Vowel sort, right? Vowel sort because, but this is like the opposite vowels, right? Selection was choose the smallest number in the list, put it in the first position, choose the second smallest number in the list, put it in the second position, and so on. Any questions about these problems? Okay. You guys are going to hate me for asking this question, but there's a sorting video that probably, I don't know how many of you have watched, but the question is, just to see how many people watched it, which sorters did the video song talk about? And options are A, bubble sort, B, selection and quick sort, C, selection and bubble sort, D, selection sort, and E, quick sort. I'm going to stop at 45. Yeah. What's that?
I didn't watch it, so any clues?
There are no clues. I mean, it's pretty straightforward if you watched it. If not, there's two. That's my clue. All right, I'm going to stop at 1 minute. Stopping? This is pretty funny. For a random question, that's a very funny distribution. C was the wrong answer. How many people have actually watched it? Can you raise your hand? You watched it? Hey. You watched it?
No. Can you please give us a clue as to where this was?
Yeah, there's a link on from the website where the lecture notes are. There's a link to it. And there's also a link from, today I'm gonna link another video. I showed them last semester in class, and people didn't like that. So, they thought it was a waste of time. So, I'm gonna give you guys homework to watch. Yeah.
Next time,
I said it in class, but sure. So there's a video linked from the website to today's lecture, and you can please watch it. All right, let's do this one. So only one of the following sentences is correct. The other ones are false. You guys have to figure out which one it is. So A says B is wrong. B says, so basically option B is wrong. B says this is the right answer. C, none of the choices is correct. D, A is the right answer. E, this is the right answer. This is a matter of life, which hopefully most people can do. Only one is correct. Which one is it?
Okay.
stopping at 145. All right, stopping in 3. Stopping. Okay. So, I think this one was, there's two possibilities. E is one of them, right? E can be, that's the only, E is the only right answer. If A is wrong, right? So let's say A is right. A says B is wrong, right? And B says this is the right answer. So B is not the right answer. Hold on, how did that work? So both A and D cannot be true at the same time, which means that A is... okay, let's do this. I think I showed myself the point. All right, so if A is right, so let's make A, B, C, D, E. Let's say A is true. That means that B is wrong. That means that C is wrong. That means that D is right too. Okay? So that's impossible, right? So which means that A is definitely not. Is definitely false. Which means that B is right, which means that C is wrong, which means that D is wrong, and we don't know about E. E's not dependent on any of that, right? So this is one possibility. Well, I guess if B is right, then that means that E is wrong because only one of them can be right. So that's an option, and false, 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 true is another option. So there's two right answers. Yeah?
I don't think false, 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 true would be wrong, because that would mean A would be right.
Right. So false, you're saying that A, B, C, D, E. Okay. So that's not possible because A says... B is wrong, and that means that B would be right. Okay? Does that make sense? So the right answer is B. Thanks. I'm so happy that I have people who pay attention. That's great. All right. Let's do some gross kind of questions. So we've seen this before. You have N streets and N avenues, and the way you walk is, the way you walk is you go from the bottom left corner all the way up, and then you go down the diagonal like the picture. So the question is, if your walk looks like the one in the picture, how far do you go? How many blocks do you walk? And the answers are A, big O of log N, B, big O of N, C, big O of N log N, D, big O of N squared, and E, big O of 1. Did I start it? I didn't start it. Stopping at 110. Five more seconds.
shopping. Okay. All right. That doesn't look right.
So let's just see, compute how long we go. Okay. How long is this path? So length or number of blocks is okay. So that's n, right? Plus how big is this path?
I agree with that. Any questions? Let's do this one. So again, you have n blocks and n avenues and n streets. You start on in the bottom left corner, and you walk one block. You walk one block horizontally, then one block up, then two blocks horizontally, and another block vertically. Okay? So that's how you walk. The question is, how many blocks do you go as a function of n? Yeah.
Or you just start, like, you know you're stopping there.
You know you're stopping there. Okay? What is, how many blocks do you walk? Again, the same options. We go of a, we go of log n, b, we go of n, c, we go of n log n, d, we go of n squared, and e, we go of 1. stopping at 220. Stopping. I don't like that either.
So how many blocks do you walk? What's the answer?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay? So number of blocks equals 5. How many blocks do I walk if n is 100? How many blocks do I walk if n is 1,000? How many blocks do I walk if n is 1,000,000? 5. It's a constant of n, which is also called big O of 1. That's what big O of 1 means. Okay? So it's a constant. It's not a function of no matter what you do, you're always going to walk 5 blocks. No matter how big the city is, you're going to walk the same number of blocks. It's like the sorted list that you have to find the max number in a sorted list, right? It doesn't matter how big the list is. You just have to go and look at the last number of the list. All right. After this depressing set of questions, let's dive back into our lectures. So we've been talking about contradictions, and we talked about oxymorons and how oxymorons are just two terms put together that have kind of contradictory meanings. And we said that though the contradiction is not very deep because it's not like you take the literal, meaning of them. You kind of, it's a relative, you take kind of a relative meaning. We showed a few contradictions that we see, you know, in our day-to-day lives. These are a little deeper, I guess. But, the idea is that you really shouldn't, from a logical standpoint, you shouldn't be able to make a statement that interpreted correctly results in some kind of contradiction. And so, you know, there's all kind of paradoxes like that, you know, like what happened if we would be able to travel in time? There's all kind of paradoxes that happen, like being able to kill your own grandfather, what would you be if your grandfather was, you would kill him? And so there are a lot of deep mathematical issues, deep mathematical problems and insights that use this idea. And let's look at a few of them. There's something called Russell's paradox. And what that is okay, let's make, the story goes that there's a barber in a little town, and the barber shaves every man in town who does not shave himself. And the question is, who shaves the barber? Okay? His wife? Well, it says that the barber is required to shave every man in town who doesn't shave himself. So his wife doesn't shave anybody. He shaves all... No, but, I mean, you can work, right? So what would be... If we said they, what could be a possibility that would make this work? If it was a woman, right, she would need to shave her face. You know, hopefully. So, but you know, if you take this statement as the barber is a man, it's a he, and he shaves every man who doesn't shave himself, and let's say the barber needs shaving, this is a self-contradictory statement, right? There's no way to make it true. I mean, unless you guys can come up with something. I haven't been able to. So, no?
He's a child.
Okay, that's another way to work. Good. All right. So a lot of cool ideas come from the set theory. We call it naive set theory today because we know that there's flaws in it. But people didn't used to, in the beginning it wasn't called naive set theory. People used to believe that you can do math and set theory any way you wanted to do it. And so the barber problem illustrates something that comes up in the naive set theory, which is if you're able to make self-referential statements, you run into trouble. And so Gödel was a person, a very, very smart guy. He lived in New Jersey about 100 years ago. And he was friends with Einstein, which is that picture. I think that's a cool picture. But what he said was he actually, when he was 20-something, 25, he came up with a whole theory that said that, you know, there are statements in math that can actually not be proven if they're true or false. And that kind of blew the bubble of mathematicians because that was their job. That was the mathematician's job to take a statement and prove if it's true or false. And he showed that there are statements that you cannot decide if they're. That's an undecidable problem. You can't figure that out for. There are questions that you cannot answer. And he also came up with something like, he made up a statement that says, this statement cannot be proven. Okay? And so this is an impossible statement, right? Is this statement true or false? Well, if it's true, then you cannot prove it, right? So not every true statement in math can be proven. If it's false, this statement cannot be proven. It can be proven, but it's false. So you can't prove something that's false, which is, you know, there are statements that are false that you can prove, which is not okay. So that means that the whole theory is inconsistent. So this is the statement that he used to show that you might not be able to prove that a statement is true or false. And the problem here too is that this statement is making a reference to itself. So that's, you can't do that. If you do that, you run into trouble. If you stay out of self-referential statements, you should be okay. So there are certain rules to defining these theories and very strict things. Another very interesting problem is the problem of counting. And Cantor actually, he looked at sets and how, you know, comparing sets are, for example, how many positive integers are there in the world? How many odd numbers? Are they the same size of infinity? So how would you, if I ask you, here are two sets, are they the same size? How would you show if they're the same size or not? Let's say the set of all the apples in a grocery store and the set of all the squashes in the grocery store. How would you answer the question, are they the same size? Yeah.
Take inventory
and count them, right? So you say, okay, there's this many apples and there's this many squashes. They're the same size or they're not the same size. Now, let's take something else. What do you think? Are all the odd numbers and all the even numbers, are those sets equal? Are they the same size? You obviously can't count them, right? Tough question, right? All right, intuitively, they're the same size, right? You have 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and so on. And you have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and so on. So Cantor said that the sets are the same size if you can basically pair up numbers in the two sets, find a unique kind of pairing between the numbers and so in here, you can pair up 1 and 2. I'm going to make a little arrow. Pair up 3 and 4, 5 and 6, 7 and 8, 9 and 10, and so on. And you have to find the pairing is actually a function, which says, okay, take a number in this set. What is the function that gives me the pair of it in this next set? And it would be, if x is a number in this set, it would be x plus 1. Right, and this is a unique pair. No matter what number you choose in this set, you always have a pair in this set, and that's unique. No matter what number you choose in this set, you just subtract 1 and get a pair in this set. And that's kind of, it shows that they're the same size of infinity.
Okay, so far so good. Let's try another one. What about the positive integers? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and all the odd numbers. So 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11. Are they the same size? Oh, I think. Can we find a pairing that would uniquely pair up these numbers with these numbers? How about if a number in this set is X? How about 2x minus 1? Does that work? So x is 1, 2 minus 1 is 1. If x is 2, 4 minus 1 is 3. If x is 3, 6 minus 1 is 5, and so on. And this uniquely, if I, any number I take in this set, I can find a pair for it in this set. Okay? And this is a little counterintuitive, right? Like, you always feel like, yeah, but, you know, this set is missing this number, and this number, and this number. It doesn't matter. It's infinity. It's weird. They're the same size. They're the same size infinity. Okay? Let's try another one. What about all the positive integers and all the integers? Minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What would be a, can we make a pairing to pair up these numbers with these numbers? what can we do? Let's work together. So we need to associate, how are we going to make the pairs first? How can we? There's a lot of ways, but let's try to make pairs. Okay, why don't we do? Okay, so if we were to list all of them, how would we do it? Let's try to list these. What's a way to list this set? How would you talk about this set? Other than saying this is all the integers in the world, in the that we have. My amount of infinity is very, well, let's start with zero, okay? Zero. Go on. What's the next one?
Zero to one.
Zero.
I was thinking of like sets, so like those stuff.
That's good. What do we think about lists? Yeah.
0, 1, negative 1, 2, negative 2, negative 2.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And now we have to find, let's say we pair the 0 with 1, 1 with 2, 2, minus 1 with 3, 2 with 4, 5, 6, 7. Let's do that. Okay? Any pairing works. How would we write this in this? So this is good. Can we do this? Would this work? This would work, right? Because we have an infinite number of numbers here. We have an infinite number of numbers here. 4 minus 4. We can just do this for however long we want. So this means that these two sets are the same size infinity. But can we write this in a short way? Like before, when we use x and 2x minus 1. So if these are x, what would these be? Or let's do the opposite. Let's do these are x, and what would these be? It doesn't have to be perfect. Just, yeah, try something. you can use if. Let's call this y.
Same size sets. It's very weird because they're infinite sets, but that's kind of the definition of it. So we can see this as having boxes and putting each number in a box. And however many boxes we're going to have, that's how many things are in the list. So if you have four boxes, we have four numbers. We can put the four numbers in the four boxes. If we have an infinite number, we're going to need an infinite number of boxes. Now this is kind of, if the two sets are the same size, we're going to be able to pair, this is the idea of pairing them up. So you're going to be able to pair up 1 and 2 and put them in one box, 2 and 4 and put them in the other box, and so on. And you're going to have the same, you're going to need the same number of boxes, or you can just put the pairs in just one box. So that means that they're the same size as infinity. Now we can go further, and we can think about fractions and decimals. Right, so fractions, all of a sudden, it seems like there's tons more, right? You get this feel that, you know, if you have all the fractions in the world, but let's look at that. And another notion is the notion of countable. And countable just means that it's either a countable set is just a finite set that you can actually count, or an infinite set that you can find some kind of function like that, a pairing with the integer number. So how can we, let's see if we can make a list of all the fractions. So there's a lot of fractions out there, and it's very hard to figure out where to start, but I'll give you a starting point. Let's only think about the fractions that are smaller than 1. So the numerator is always smaller than the denominator, and they're always integer numbers. The numerator and the denominator are integers. I'm pretty sure that you can always bring a fraction in that form. And so we're going to order them this way. We're going to order them as, first we're going to list all the fractions where the sum of the numerator and the denominator is 1. Then we're going to list all of the ones that have the sum of the numerator and the denominator is 2. Then 3, 4, and so on. So the first one
0 over 1, that's the numerator plus denominator is 1. For the sum equals 2, we have 0 over 2 and 1 over 1. For the sum 3, 0 over 3 and 1 over 2, and so on. Okay? So we can list all of them. We can list all the fractions. We've made a list of, we don't know where it ends, but I can tell you, if you give me a fraction, I can tell you exactly where it is in the list, and I don't think that you can come up with a fraction that is not in this list. Or if you can think of any, let me know. Right? So we found a way to list all the fractions, which means that the set of all the fraction is a countable set, which means that it's the same size as the set of all the integer number, positive integer numbers. Which is crazy because it seems like there's so many more. But let's look at decimal. So it doesn't work to do that trick anymore, right? But let's say that we can list all of the decimals in the world, just like we listed the all the fractions, right? Let's assume that we can list all the decimals in the world. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to list all of them. That's like a random list. But imagine that it goes on forever, and it lists all the decimals. And what we're going to do is we're going to take the diagonal. We're going to make a new number, which is going to be, 0.589. We just read the diagonal like that. And then what we do is we add 1 to each of the decimal, to each of the digits after the decimal point. So it's going to be, 5898, da da da. That's going to be 690. Okay, if the digit is a 9, we're going to add 1 and say that it's a 0. Okay, with wraparound, it's called. Okay, so we don't change too much of the number. We just add 1. And then when we put, so the resulting decimal is not in the list, right? Because, so it's different from the first number on the first digit after the dot, right? Because we added 1 to it. It differs from the second one in the second digit we added. It differs in the third one, and so on, because we added 1 to all the digits. So this new number is not on the list, which means that we cannot make a list of all the decimals, because we started by assuming we can make a list of all the decimals, and we found one that was not in the list. And so that means that we cannot make a list of all the decimals, which means that we finally found a list that is not a set, that is not countable. So this size of infinity is different than this size of infinity. Okay? So there's tons more decimal than, in a very significant way, than fractions. Okay, so the conclusions are that you cannot make a list of all the decimals, but you can make a list of all the fractions, and there are more decimal than fractions. All right, so which brings us to the main problem that I want to talk about. It's talking about looping. And sometimes you have loops in Scratch, and what, can you guys figure out what the first little script does? There's three scripts. What does the first one do? So it says set I to 10, repeat until I equals 0, place on pop, change I by minus 1. It pops 10 times until it gets to 0. And all those scripts do exactly the same thing, but some of them use, the first one uses repeat until, the second one uses repeat, and the third one uses a forever loop, and then in the forever loop, if some condition is met, like I is smaller than 1, you stop the script. All right, so for each of the scripts, is there a value that you can think of? So for where it says set I to 10, can I replace 10 with something else so that the script will never stop? Yeah. Negative 1. So if it's set to negative 1, it says repeat until I equals 0, and then changes I by minus 1, it makes this minus 2. It says repeat until I equals, let me write this down, it's easier to see. So it starts with minus 1, it pops, it changes I by 1, by minus 1, and You guys see where this is going? We can not go y equals 0, minus 4. Is it ever going to reach 0? No, there's no way. So for anything that's smaller than 0, or anything that, anything that's smaller than 0 is going to pop forever. Are there any other values that you can think of that can make it pop forever? What about 1.5? Would that work? What happens for 1.5? It's not equal to 0, so it's going into the loop. It's making it change I by minus 1. It's making it minus 0.5. It's still not, 0.5. It's still not equal to 0. It subtracts 1. It makes it minus 0.5. And minus 1.5, and so on. And so it's never going to hit exactly 0. All right? So for each of those scripts, you can find an initial value of I that makes it loop forever. And this is called the halting problem. The halting problem says when if you work to write a program, sometimes you write a program and you run it, and it runs for a long time and you have no idea if it's ever going to stop or not. You don't know if there's an infinite loop in it. You don't know what happened. It would be very, very helpful if somebody would come up with a program that would test your program and would say, is this gonna halt or is it not gonna halt? And by halt I mean stop, right? If it's eventually gonna stop. Yeah.
Is it like difficult to make a program like
that? It's actually, we're gonna show that it's impossible to make a program like that. So, but it would be very helpful, right? So, you could say, I'm actually gonna make this program, and I'm gonna say, run your program. And if it hasn't stopped in 20 minutes, then declare that it's never going to stop. But what if it stops after 25 minutes? And then you're wrong, right? So it's a little slippery even intuitively. But let's assume that we can make a halt test, right? If there's a website, and you can go to the website, and you can upload your scratch program, and your halt tester will say, this will stop, or it could say, this will not stop. And then you'll know, and you'll be happy. You'll know that somewhere in there you have an infinite loop. Okay, so halt tester returns true if the program halts and false if the program doesn't halt. So this is our little halt tester. It's a program that takes another program as input, a scratch program for example, and says either this script will stop, so the answer is true, or this script will not stop, so the answer is false. In this case, I know you guys probably have a hard time seeing the script, but it's actually a program that stops. Yeah?
So, does this mean, going back to the Turing machine, there can never be a non-quantum to the Turing machine that we can look at a program and say it will stop on all the sites? And if a program can't, unless it's quantum?
Can you think of the way how quantum could change that?
It superpositions into every state.
Right. So the only thing that quantum can do is to take something like exponential and make it linear. But if it's going to run forever, they're both infinite times. So it's the same thing. The size of the input doesn't matter as much. This is a deeper problem. But yeah. So this is. Let's assume that we have this program, okay? Can you, just a little print, can you guys remember another program that takes as input a program and outputs a program? So we said that compilers are, the compiler is a program that takes as input a program and turns it into machine language. All right, close for n, never mind, forget I asked that. So let's assume that we can make this halt tester. All right. So this is our halt tester. And Scratch does not let you make a subroutine that takes a program as input, but some programs do. So let's assume that we can actually implement this halt tester. And this halt tester, as we said before, takes as input a program and outputs true or false. if it stops. Now, let's assume that we write a scratch program that says the following. It's a subroutine, it's called contrary, and what it's doing is saying if the program fed to the call tester is me, so I'm contrary, I'm basically going to run the call tester on me, and I'm going to say, let's see what call tester says. If call tester says that I'm going to stop, so if answer equals 1, true, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into an infinite loop. I'm going to say forever, play sound, pop until done. So I input myself to the hall tester. I'm saying, okay, what does the hall tester say about me? It's saying that I'm stopping. I'm not going to stop. If the hall tester says that I'm actually not going to stop, I'm stopping. So I'm doing exactly the contrary that the hall tester says. It's almost like saying, okay, let's say that one of you guys says, I can predict about anybody in the world if they're going to take the red pill or the blue pill, okay? And I'm saying, okay, what about me? Am I going to take the red pill or the blue pill? And you say the blue pill, and I'm taking the red pill. If you say the red pill, I'm going to take the blue pill. Okay, so I'm going to prove you wrong. This is what the contrary does. So let's assume that, I'm contrary, okay? So I'm feeding myself into the hall tester. I'm saying, what is the hall tester going to say about me? Broadcast hall tester and wait. And I set the program, so hall tester takes the program as input, and I set the program to be contrary, to be me. And if the answer is 0, if the answer is false, if the hall tester says that I'm not going to stop, so hall tester says that contrary will not halt, I stop. I go to, so notice there's an if, answer equals 1, and there's no else, so if the if statement is not true, it's ending the subroutine. If the hall tester says that I'm going to stop, I'm going to the if statement. If answer is equals 1, I'm going to the forever loop, and I'm not stopping. So this means that we can't make this hall tester. There's no way of making it because I can always break it. I can always make something that's kind of on the top layer above it and asks it a question and then does the opposite, right? You know, if you have some kind of annoying friend and they're like, I can predict anything about you, you know, what you can do is just, okay, what am I going to drink? Well, are you going to drink Diet Coke? No, I'm going to drink the beer. So you can always do that. And that's kind of the idea of the hall tester. And this is the video that I'm not going to show right now that you guys can go and watch. It's pretty long, too. It's made by Michael. By the way, Michael will be having a guest lecture in this class on December 2nd. Does that make sense? That does not make sense. 5th, I think. December 6th. And so he's a very, very entertaining, professor. So. But you guys can watch his video. He sings and everything. It's really fun. I'm going to skip this slide because it's talking about the song. Maybe I'll ask a question about the song next time. Hint, hint. All right. So what we found is that there's not a lot of problems in the real world that are both useful and are unsolvable. Most problems can be solved. By problem, I mean, let's say, just something that the computer can help with. Booking flights, finding the cheapest flight, or any kind of problem that they use computers for. But this problem, the halting problem, is unsolvable, and we just showed that it's unsolvable. And so, some people say that, well, yeah, but what we just said before, right? We looked at a script, and we were able to say, right, I'm looking at the script, and if I is minus 1, then this thing will not halt, right? We can do that, and actually, we're going to do a lot of problems like that. And so, people use that to say that, you know, we're fundamentally smarter than computers, because computers cannot solve the halting problems. But here's a counterexample of that. So, let's say you have a script, and it starts with a number. It says, set I to x to 22, and then it repeats until x is smaller than 2, It says x, and if x is an even number, it divides it by 2. And if it's an odd number,
it multiplies it by 3 and adds 1. This is a very simple. So I have a scratch script here. And we can start with 22. So do you guys think that this program would stop? Oh, let's just run it. Can you guys see it? Okay, so if it's 22, if the number is even, it divides it by 2. If the number is odd, it multiplies it by 3 and adds 1. So you can see that the even numbers get smaller and smaller. If there's an odd number, it becomes bigger. Actually, multiply by 3 and added 1. But it stopped. Let's try another number. What about 100? So it's almost like, it looks like it's getting close and then it's getting big again. And it's getting close again and... it's very hard to predict. 5, 16, and when it hits a power of 2, it's definitely going to divide it by 2, divide it by 2, divide it by 2, reach 1, and it's going to stop. So this is one example. Does anybody have an example that we can give to the cat and see if it stops or not? What's that? Negative 4? Let's try positive. Odd 123? Oh, it's pretty good. It's getting big. So the question would be, are there values for which this program doesn't stop? That would be the halting problem. So for which values, you know, of n or of x, does this eventually stop? And it turns out 123 was defeated. What's that?
Decimal?
Let's just try positive integers. I think it's me. What's that? Just positive integers. Well, it says repeat until x is smaller than 1, than 2. So whatever we start with, if it's a negative number, it's going to stop from the beginning. What did you suggest? Some decimal?
Like 15.5.
Let's see if we can break it. Right, because it's never divisible. It's never an even number, right? So it keeps going up, right? So it's always going to go, whoa, all right, before my computer explodes, I'm going to stop it. So, yeah, that was a good one. Right, that's why I said, you know, integer numbers. Because it never goes in, if you start with a decimal number, it never goes in here. So what brings it closer to 1 is actually never happening. So you always multiply by 3 and add 1, which obviously makes it explode at some point. All right? So this is one example, but okay, if you only use integer numbers, there's no way of knowing, okay, for which values is not going to stop. Right? So this is an example of it can run for a long time, but and it can look like it's not going to stop, but it's actually it hit 16, 8, 4, 2, 1, stopped, right? So that can happen at any point. Okay, so that's one problem. Another very interesting thing is that you can actually make. Okay, question: can you make a program that will kind of reproduce itself? So, can you write a program so that if you feed it something, it can give birth to something else? So let's try that. We're gonna make a program. This is Python code, but what it says is, you basically, let's talk, so this program will be called, we'll call it a subber, because it substitutes some characters for other characters. So what the subber does is it takes its input a text, and it outputs a new text, And the way it does it is if there's, the text is just text, no numbers, it just copies the input to the output. If there are numbers, what it does is it replaces 2 with quotes, it replaces 3 with a whole string, it replaces 4 with end of line, 5 with tab, and so on. So what this is going to do, it's going to copy the characters to the output, and then when it runs into 2, it's going to put a quotation mark. If it runs into 3, it's going to copy the whole input to the output. 4 puts a new line, 5 does a tab, which moves it a few spaces. 6 is another new line, tab, and so on. All right, now let's try this one. Let's say that we have a subroutine, and that's our subroutine is saying, when I receive def self print, what we do is we're going to print subr of that text. Okay, so let's see what does subr of that text do. Okay, so this is our text, this is our subroutine. And what help, so subroutine kind of says subr of something. So what goes into subr is this. So what subr is going to do, as we said before, it copies all the characters to the output. So def self print, column, and then 4 puts a new line, 5 does an indent. Then it just copies the characters, friend, and then the 2 puts quotations, 3 copies the whole thing that goes into a subr back, and then it puts quotation marks again, closes the, like close paren, and what happened was we made a program that recreates the subroutine that we started with. So this looks like there's a program that prints itself, then it runs and prints itself, then it runs and prints itself. It looks like it would never end, but it actually does. We can just run it once and have our, you know, go back to and recreate the same subroutine. So I'm gonna move on to. So this is all of the chapter with the halting problem. We are going to practice more on the halting problem next time. I'd like to move on to compression now, and we're going to finish that next time. So what is compression? So we said that everything in a computer is represented by bits and sequences of bits. And sometimes those bits, we need lots and lots and lots of them. And we had on the midterm the first problem. You know, we had a picture with pixels, and how many bits does it take to sort this picture, blah, blah, blah. It would be very, very helpful if we can make that information smaller so we can fit better. And so we would like it to be, it's easier to process if it's smaller, and it's easier, it's shorter, and so on. So what are some things that we can compress? What the typical things that we compress are text or images or videos. And for example, for images, the way sometimes people do it is they look for areas in the image that have the same color. And so they kind of select those. This is pretty, a very bad approximation. But they take areas in the picture that have the same color, and then they say, this is the area, and this is the color that it is. So you don't have to store all the pixels. You only have to store the color, which can be one pixel, and kind of, you know, where those pixels are, which is a big improvement. And sometimes you see something that looks like this because it's kind of compressed. So if you go on the internet, you have a very small picture of something, and you blow it up and zoom in, and it's going to look like a whole bunch of squares. It looks very very small resolution. But that's okay, because sometimes you need, you know, if you want to load web pages and stuff like that, it's easier to have the compressed version. And, you know, you can get the idea that that's a flower and you might be happy with that. But how do people do compression? So they start by, let's say that the image is, what is it made of? Well, you can see it as a list of lines. And you know that this line goes this way, you have the coordinates maybe, and so on. Or you can see it as a list of regions with color. Either way, when you do compression, you look for any type of, some kind of regularity in the pattern.
So anything that's regular, you can compress it pretty well. If there's a whole area that has the same color, that can be compressed very easily into just one pixel and the coordinates of that area. Another thing that people do is video compression, and there's a lot of theory there, but the one that's very interesting is macro blocking. Sometimes when you watch digital TV, there's whole chunks in the picture, in the image, that just look like just a square of the same color, and you don't really understand what's happening. So the video you're streaming, the video is streaming, and maybe it's not fast enough, the information doesn't come fast enough, and so they have to make a compromise of resolution. You actually can watch, there's a video, there's a video that's the macro blocking is very clear in that video. Maybe I'll have some time to show it next time. But we're going to mainly be talking about compressing text. And compression text compression also looks for regularity in the data. So let's say you have the Gettysburg Address, and one way to do it is how many times does each character show up in the Gettysburg Address? And let's say that we ignore uppercase, we treat uppercase like lowercase, and we have 282 spaces for I'm not sure what B was. I think it was like blank character, whatever. 22 commas, 15 dashes, 10 points, and so on. Right. So we just count all the characters that are in the text. So how can we compress it? So ASCII is a one way of representing text in the computer, and it basically says each letter has an 8-bit code. And you're going to replace each letter with that 8-bit code. So you have 1,482 characters in the Gettysburg Address. So you need 1,482 times 8, right? Each character. It's 8 bits. So you're going to need, this is for one letter, equals 8 bits. How many bits do you need for 1,482 characters? 1,482 times 8, and that probably gives you 11,854, 56 bits. Okay, but you just multiply that. All right, so remember that 11,854 if you don't compress, if you just represent the information in the computer like that. Well, let's try to do better, right? So in the Gettysburg Address, you don't actually use all the characters in the alphabet. So ASCII covers everything that's on your keyboard and more, I think. So we actually don't use all letters. We don't use all the symbols. If we count how many different characters we have, actually, if we count all of these, how many different ones we have, we're going to come up with 32. There's 8 per column. We have 4 columns. 32 different characters. With 32 different characters, we only need 5 bits, right? So between 0000 and 1111, how many numbers are there? Well, this is 0 in decimal, and this is 31. So 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 31, 32 combinations. We assign one combination to one character, and we have 5 bits per character. So that saves us 3 bits for one character, which basically almost, it's a 62.5% of the size of the original text, right? Which is pretty good. Okay, so does this make sense? We just come up with codes for 5-bit codes for each character, and we only need 5 bits per character. So now it's going to be 5 times 18, 11, I don't remember how many characters there were, but we get 5 bits per character, and 7,410 total bits.
Okay, so for example, this could be our coding, which is just random. So you have 0000 for space for the first one, 4001 for the B or the blank or whatever that is, 0001 10 for a comma, and so on. So we just assign the codes to the characters like that. But the thing is that some of the characters show up much more frequently than other characters. So if we have a variable length code, that would be very helpful. Let's say we assign a 1-bit code to the most frequent character, so then we're going to save a lot of space, and then we're not going to care about. So let's say we have 1-bit character for the most frequent, a 2-bit character for the next frequent, a 3-bit character. That does not sound like a very good idea. So what we're going to do is we're going to choose the four most common characters, and we're going to assign them a 3-bit code, and the remaining we're going to assign a 6-bit code. Okay? How many bits do we need now? So we're going to do this. We're going to say that the most frequent characters have all the 3-bit codes. And all the rest of them have 6-bit codes. Did I use all the 3-bit codes that are available? How many numbers can you make with 3 bits? 8, right? But I didn't use them. Why do you think I didn't use all of them? Why didn't I use the rest of them? How would I write, okay, let's say cat. So cat would be, C is 101000, and 0. A is 011, and T is 010. How do I decode it? Like, let's say you guys compress your text and you send it to me. How do I decode this code? How do I know what this means? Well, go ahead.
The one is just sound like you're taking the next 5 bits.
Right.
Turn the letter 0 to signal for taking the next 2.
So I need the first bit to say if it starts with a 0, it's going to be a 3-bit code. If it starts with a 1, it's going to be a 6-bit code. If I had 3-bit codes that started with a 1, how would I know if this is a... Is this a 3-bit code, or is this a 6-bit code? There would be no way of me knowing that, right? So I need to have 1 bit reserved for, this is going to be a short code, or this is going to be a long code. And when I see it starting with a 1, I know, oh, this is a long code. I'm going to take 6 bits. And then I can know, okay, this is a 6-bit code. I can look in the table, and I can match it, and I get C. Then the next one is start with a 0, so this is going to be a 3-bit code. And I can look in the table and I can see that it's an A. And this is also a 0, a short code. Look at the table, it's a T. So that's why I can't use all the 3-bit codes, that because I need one bit to encode if it's a short code or if it's a long code. All right? So this is just saying that the code is chosen so that each of the short codes starts with a 0, each of the long codes starts with a 1, and then if I were to decode it, I know that it starts with a 1, so I'm going to look at 6 bits and so on, right? And then when I'm done with the 6 bits, I have the next code, I know exactly what it starts with, and I know if it's a short or long code. So this is harder to work with than the previous codes, but it usually works better in practice than the other one. So, okay, this is just showing that I look at the H, and then my next code starts with a 1 again, it's going to be a 6 one. The next one starts with a 0, it's going to be a short one. The next one starts with a 0 again, it's going to be a short one, long one, short one, long one, short one, long one. And I'm done. And so the in this case, for the Gettysburg Address, for this text, the length actually grows. We need more bits to use the third encoding than the second encoding. So we actually need to come up with some kind of encoding that uses how many more characters are, how many more of the this kind of character are than of the next character. And so let's try this. How do we know how many bits we need if we have, let me go up. If we have this kind of encoding, how do I know how many bits I need for, let's say we use higher. How many bits do I need? What's the total number of bits? All right, you can just tell me what the math is. How do I figure that out? How many bits do I need for H? 6. What about I? What about space? What about T? 3. H? E? And R? Okay, so I have 6 times 1, 2, 3, 4 plus 1, 2, 3, 4. And that gives me 24 plus 12, 36. So it's basically, how can I do this in a more smart way? Well, I can say it's twice the number of bits for H. Right? So I have two H's plus 1 times the number of bits for I plus 1 times the number of bits for T plus twice the number of bits for E. Right? I have two E's plus 1 times the number of bits for R. So if I have the Gettysburg Address, which is bigger, I'm going to count 128 spaces show up. So I'm going to do 128 times 3 plus I don't know how many E's there are, times 3, and so on. So the way I can compute the number of bits that is needed is, the total number of bits is, you sum over all the characters in your text, multiply the frequency, so the frequency of H times the number of bits I need for H. The frequency of